This is the new Weight Watchers. It works for members like JoJo, who's learning simple, healthy habits, Sharia, who's making progress with meds, and Kim, who still gets to eat what she loves. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now, it's your turn. Watch your life open up. Watch your story shift. Watch what you're capable of. Watch it work. Get started today at WeightWatchers.com.
That's kind of conversation between the soul. That's conversation between the soul and the mind.
Prestige heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade Derek Davison, and we're very excited to welcome back to the podcast today Shadi Hamid. Shadi is a columnist at the Washington Post, and he's also the author of the recently released The Case for American Power. Shadi, thank you so much for joining us yet again.
Thanks so much for having me.
So this book is, as it says, The Case for American Power. But before we get into that, I first looked at the blurbs. This is like the lib pantheon up here. Noah Feldman, Francis Fukuyama, Michael McFaul, friend of the pod, and Anne-Marie Slaughter. Oh my God, it's the fearsome foursome of the lib foreign policy establishment. Couldn't get any Bernie bros, Shadi, to blurb you? I was not asked, I must say.
Four of the people who I have in a shrine, actually, they're photographs in a shrine. You can't see it on the camera. But, yeah.
There was actually one Bernie adjacent person who I wanted to give a blurb, but that person ended up having too many disagreements with the book.
Oh, okay.
So that didn't work out.
Fair. All right. So it's funny. It's funny, Shadi, because we were just at Bob Wright's podcast. We're not quite sure whether this will come out because book episodes are always evergreen, but probably the last Bob Wright podcast. And he was referring to you as someone on the left. So I guess why don't we start there? Where do you situate yourself politically? Because I think that might be useful, because one of my big things is that like left-right really doesn't make sense for most of American history. It doesn't really make sense today. So the language is kind of maybe more occluding than illuminating. But like I said, these are all like very lib foreign policy people. I don't know Noah's necessarily. I mean, I imagine he's more on the liberal internationalist side, but I know Fukuyama, McFaul, and Slaughter, of course. But yeah, so where do you situate yourself politically?
Yeah, so I'm definitely of the left. That's where I kind of got my political chops, and I became politicized by being part of the anti-war movement during the Iraq War. So I have this kind of sense of appreciation for that part of my life. And it's really important to me because I still actually share many of the leftist critiques of foreign policy, which we can get into. During the Biden years, during peak woke, I started to wonder whether or not I was really a progressive, because progressivism was becoming something that I could no longer recognize. It was so obsessed with these culture war issues that I thought that I didn't fully share, whether it's about gender identity or a kind of obsession with systemic racism as the reason for everything, and everything is white supremacy. So that pushed me away a little bit.
It's funny because in my mind, that's more liberal than anything else. That's like corporate liberalism par excellence, essentially avoiding economic security. Sorry, Derek, please.
Well, it's a strange thing, right? Because I think some of the culture war stuff did originate on the left. I wouldn't go so far as to say the fixation or the like making that the sole animating cause of politics originated on the left. That to me is like very 2016 coded. Like that's the Hillary Clinton campaign's
Agreed.
Argument against Bernie Sanders, that he's not going to, you know, and what is breaking up the big banks going to do? To
end
racism.
Like, that's for goddamn
that's
sure.
That's where that fixation to me comes from.
Yeah, fair points. But just to kind of like finish, I think that the story a little bit. I think that I'm more of a progressive. I'm more on the left now because of Gaza, because of the post October 7th environment, and that became one of the defining issues on the left. I think to be a leftist now means to actually care about people who are being oppressed abroad, who are victims of a genocide. And that's when I moved away from my woke skepticism, because I was like, oh, a lot of the people who used to, who were anti-woke, who I was allied with, they turned out to be pro-Israel hardliners. So I started to wonder, maybe being a little bit woke has something to say for it, because it allows you to see that sometimes there really are victims and victimizers. And that's not always an unreasonable way to look at the world. I should also say, as you know, Danny, that I did work a bit on Bernie's foreign policy team. And I think that's how I sort of got to know you initially in 2020. So I have been a Bernie supporter. That doesn't necessarily make me a full-blown leftist, but I think that my inclinations have always been in that direction. So I would say I'm like on the liberal left. I consider myself a classical liberal. Yeah. Who's also critical of what liberalism has become. So I'm heterodox in that sense. And sometimes people see me as being a little bit all over the place. But I think post October 7th, I know where I stand on one of the key defining issues of our time. And I think that makes me more comfortable saying that I'm on the left in some sense. I was very enthusiastic about Zohran Mamdani, huge fan of his. I think what he's doing is incredible. I think there's something to be said for avoiding the culture war issues and having this relentless focus on affordability. He did that very well. Bread and butter issues matter, even though that's not what I focus on in my own work. I don't actually think people are primarily motivated by material interests. I think our emotional self-interest often takes precedence, and that's why cultural issues are so important, and questions around religion and how to live a good life. And because I am religious myself, I think that's often seen as right-coded. So when people see me talking about the importance of having religion in public life, or the fact that I want Christianity to play more, I want more people to be Christian, not in the evangelical pro-Trump way, but in the kind of genuine Christianity that I believe is still there. So I think those things confuse people about me, but I don't think that to be a religious believer means you have to be on the right. And that's an unfortunate development of recent times, that we've kind of ceded that to the right.
So Shadi, before we get into really going through the main argument of the book, because you brought it up, I want to ask, working on a book that's called The Case for American Power, writing this, I mean, I don't know what the exact timeline was. And, you know, obviously there was some lead time before the book was published, but you're working on this during Gaza. Did that change your approach to the book or the topic? And if so, in what ways? I'm curious how you're holding that thought in your head at the same time that you're watching what's happening in Gaza.
So I wrote a lot of the book pre-October 7th, and then I sort of took a break because Gaza really, it was a breaking point for me, and I had to think to myself, wait, am I really comfortable still writing a book that would be called The Case for American Power when America is so intertwined in our horrific policies in supporting Israel and what it was doing in Gaza? And I thought to myself, am I comfortable telling progressives and my fellow Arab and Muslim Americans that they should believe in America when America is doing these awful things on an issue that is so deeply important for a lot of us in the community? So I took a little bit of a break because I had to ponder that. I did, I think, find a way to reframe some of the book and rewrite it. And the parts that I hadn't had written yet became more influenced by Gaza. But I think in the book, it should be clear to people, and I hope you guys got a sense of it, I'm wrestling with it and I'm going back and forth. And I even say in the first chapter that I didn't come to my conclusions either easily or enthusiastically. And I think that's maybe an odd thing for a book, for the author to be in this state of anguish and lack of certainty. But I actually think that's what we should do when we're writing a book. we shouldn't have a foregone conclusion. We should be wrestling with our own arguments. And throughout the book, there is this undercurrent of doubt that I think I want people to see that, because it's not an easy argument. And we should have doubts about America. At the end of the day, with all of my reservations, with all of my caveats, I still felt this was the right argument to make. And it's not so much the case for American power. It's more a case for an American power, almost a kind of idealized vision of what I think America can still be. I do think there is a way to use American power for good. And I try to provide a roadmap for what that might look like in a way that I hope is somewhat aligned with progressive aspirations. And that's why the question of morality and the fact that we can be better than we actually are is really central in the book. So in some sense, it's an anguished manifesto. That's the way that I like to describe the book. And maybe it can be a source of inspiration for progressives who really don't like what America has become, but still have this sense that we're capable of improving. That the fact that we've sucked for so long is not this kind of permanent reality.
So I think I've got a more fundamental question I'm going to leave to the side for a second, but let's stick on the question of morality, because maybe this is my training as a historian. Because at what point does someone who has your perspective say that history suggests, at the very least, that there are tendencies? Nothing is predetermined. I do believe that human beings have free will and that we are agents. But I also believe that one can look at historical reality and suggest that there are tendencies to how certain types of power get exercised. We could go very far. If you want to, be a classic political scientist, we could start talking about Thucydides, but just look at American power since World War II. When I look at the ledger of that, it's not really an open question as to whether this power does more good or makes things worse in the world. I think that so many, as you are well aware, not beyond Korea and Vietnam, there are so many lives have been destroyed by American power. And so that one could say that from a philosophical point of view, people or agents or structures are capable of change. At what point do you say that this is such a tendency in the way that power operates that maybe it's not possible, the way that I put it simply, is to have the good parts of empire without the bad parts of empire, that you can't get a just war or supportive for a just war like Ukraine, if you think Ukraine is a just war, without getting Gaza, that those things are actually dependent on one another. When does one as an analyst say that actually power can't be used? Or is it just like an almost religious faith, which is what I actually take you to mean, which is that I don't care if Jesus hasn't come back for 2,000 years, he may come back in the future, which to me is almost a Kierkegaardian leap of faith that might not be the most appropriate lens through which to analyze international relations or the use of a state power that exists in actual history. So that's my first core question I want to ask.
So the first thing is that I don't think the record is all bad post-World War II.
No, it's not all bad. It's really good in the global north. Like, let's just not, yes. Yeah. Western Europe and Central Europe worked. The global south was fucking horrible. Like, deadly. Deadly, deadly, deadly. But so I want to seed that point. Yes, it was good if you were in Western or Central Europe.
But that's also a really important point that we shouldn't just push to the side. I mean, in the institutions we created after Bretton Woods, these multilateral institutions that help preserve the peace in Europe, the fact that the EU as a project would not have been possible without America's security umbrella. And of course, the fact that we saved Europe during World War II. And then there's also the dramatic expansion of democracies post-World War II, which I think we've talked about.
This is very political science-y, right? Like, I would say that there's a dramatic expansion of procedural democracy, which to me is less important.
And I'm fine with that. I don't think
substantive.
I don't think that every democracy...
It's less of an accomplishment. It's less of like, when people talk about this way, about democracy, as you know, it's a very flattening term. And two, the vote itself has expanded, which is good. I agree with that. I am ultimately in favor of democracy. I don't think a Leninist cadre could work. And there are many reasons that it doesn't actually work in practice. But that is a weak case. I actually think, because a lot of these democracies in practice have not been substantive. They have contributed to oligarchy. They have contributed to dislocation. They have contributed to many other negative things. So I agree. If you look at the Freedom House rankings, democracy has increased. That actually doesn't get at the real story there. So I just want to also cede that point that formal democracy has increased, but that's not.
But for me, that's for me, that's a very big deal. I'm not someone who thinks that every country needs to become a fully fledged liberal substantive democracy. Even procedural democracy is a major improvement over what people had previously, which was often brutal authoritarian regimes. And I think it's, and I talk about
but
this
how do
in
you
book.
Judge that? Just very quickly, because like the famous case is that like now Russians love Stalin and hate Gorbachev, right? So like it's just like a it's more complex than that, than to just say from a normative position that democracy qua democracy is always an improvement. When if you actually look how people experience their lives, that might not actually be the case. We don't have to get into that because it's a whole debate, but I actually think that's like not necessarily true, even though like you and I agree normatively, people having a say over what happens in their state, at least theoretically, is positive. In historical reality, it's actually more complex, but yeah.
Look, it's a fair point. Democracies are messy. They are frightening to people because you don't always know who's going to win the next election. And the people who might win, you might really hate. That's always the challenge. But this is all a continuum and it's all relative. And I think we should see wins where they come. And also being originally from a region of the world that is pretty much all brutal dictatorships, I would take a partial illiberal democracy in those countries over what we currently have, which is dictatorship any day of the week. I mean, I'm talking here about the Middle East. And having lived under some of those regimes, of course, as an American citizen, so I had some privilege, but I was able to see what it was like. And I think that kind of reminds you to not take procedural democracy for granted, that there's something beautiful about at least having the chance to vote out a leader who you don't like and to have some agency over your own life. But the other thing that I would just add to the positive ledger, and I kind of go through this in the book, and it's maybe standard political science stuff that people get sick of, but in the post-World War II period, there was not just a dramatic expansion of democracy, but a dramatic reduction in the number of interstate wars. We had less major wars compared to the pre-World War II era. The average number of battlefield deaths also decreased significantly when the U.S. was a superpower, and that continued after the Cold War ended, that we just saw less wars and less average deaths per year. Now, that's reversed somewhat in recent years because of Gaza and the Ukraine war, but I would argue that could be partly because of America's weakness and because of its decline, that when we decline, we're no longer able to play that constructive role.
But that's
role.
A tough causal case. So this is the problem. People make that argument, but they don't actually make the causal case. You could argue it was for atomic weapons. You could argue because basically interstate war ended in Europe, which was effectively what happened. You could argue because the process of settler colonialism in the Western world had mostly come to an end. The problem I have with that argument is that the causal case is actually extraordinarily difficult to make it a function of American hegemony, except when you're talking about Central and Western Europe. That's where I think there's such a clear, obvious end to war there, that I agree. But the causal argument is never carefully made because it's essentially more of a philosophical, almost ontological point than it is a historical point. Because how would you prove that vis-a-vis the counterfactuals? Atomic weapons made it very difficult to have wars between major states. And then colonialism effectively came to an end between the 40s and the 60s, at least with formal independence, to say nothing of neocolonialism. So that's the problem I have with that argument. Like, how would you prove that? It's unfalsifiable, effectively.
But if we look at the counterfactual, let's say that the Soviet Union won the Cold War, I don't think we would have seen the third wave of democratization in the 1990s. And as we've talked about before, after supporting right-wing dictatorships during the Cold War in Latin America, Asia, and Africa, the U.S. started to shift and put pressure on those authoritarian regimes in the 1980s, and that continued throughout the 1990s. And that's when we saw the peak of democratization. Would that have happened if we had lost the Cold War? So I think we can look at the counterfactual history. And I think
I think you misunderstand what the Cold War was. Like this, again, this is very political scientist. The Cold War was an American project. It wasn't there for the Soviet Union to win. I really do agree with the new literature on this, with like Anders Stevenson. Like the Cold War was essentially a way for the United States to present itself on a global stage. It wasn't like a bipolar conflict between the US and Soviet Union. That's how it was experienced at the time by some people. But I think the archival record shows that the Soviets never wanted to fight it. Like Stalin wanted to make it basically do Roosevelt's four policemen thing. Khrushchev was like trying to at least attenuate tensions. Obviously, you get detente in the 1970s. So like the Soviet Union never had a chance to win the Cold War. They don't even really think about it as a Cold War, because it really wasn't for them. It was like a total American frame that I think was ultimately a way to smuggle global domination amongst a populace for which that wasn't really popular in the 1940s. That, as you know, the traditional American thing, particularly in Europe, was to stay away from foreign entanglements, going back to the 1796 address. So I think that misapprehends what the Cold War was. What does Soviet victory even mean? What would that mean? They conquer London? I mean, what does that mean? The world becomes communist? That was so never going to happen. And this relates to another point that I want to talk to you about Russia and China today. But like, what is Soviet victory in the Cold War?
But as you know, there were leading intellectuals in the US during the Cold War who thought that communism was the future and were very skeptical about America's staying power. So at the time, I think there was a lot of uncertainty about that.
All those intellectuals are out of university positions by 1953.
No, but I'm talking about even someone like Arthur Schlesinger Jr., who took a trip to the Soviet Union in 1982.
Dude, I'm in these people's... They did not fucking think that. All those Cold War liberals did not think the Soviet Union was the future.
I mean, he literally went to Russia and came back saying, hey guys, don't underestimate communism.
Yeah, but that's using a justification in order to basically affirm American power. Like all these guys thought the United States was the future. There was a vitality to it. They thought the Soviet Union was a crumbling empire, and they weren't wrong to a large degree. I don't know. I think that was mostly... I don't think the Cold War liberals believed that the Soviet Union was a future. I think there was a worry in the 30s about the quote-unquote like dictatorial advantage that you wouldn't be able to have to go through sclerotic institutions. But by the time Schlesinger writes The Vital Center in 49, he is not a believer in the Soviet Union as a future of history. No way.
If you look at others like Robert Samuelson or John Kenneth Galbraith, they all had surprisingly nice things to say about the Soviet economic model. We can debate about, like, maybe they weren't being sincere, maybe they were just performing, who knows in the end. But I think it's very easy now in hindsight to say, well, we all knew that the Soviet Union would crumble. But obviously, at the time, it didn't feel that way. And even if we go back to 1979 and the early 80s, there were a string of Soviet wins in Latin America, in Africa, where socialist regimes came to power. It seemed like America was on the back foot. But that's all. We can debate all that. I do want to get back to one thing you said about religion, which I think is really important. And not to say America is equivalent to a religion, but it is a certain kind of faith. And maybe in some ways it's akin to a religion, at least a civic religion. And I think that just as we can say that even if Christendom or the Christian empires of past were doing awful things and Christians weren't behaving well, that didn't necessarily mean that they should give up on the Christian idea as a faith. If Muslims are doing bad things and are responsible for extremism in certain parts of the world, it doesn't mean that I, as a Muslim, give up on Islam. Similarly,
but states aren't religions. That's a categorical difference.
But if we see America as a kind of moral aspiration, as a set of ideals with its own kind of founding documents, which serve as its scripture in a way, we should continue to believe in those ideas and those commitments, even if American practice falls short of them.
So there's no way that you wouldn't believe in it. That's the point. So then this is literally a Christian leap of faith. So there's nothing that would be dispositive. That's my question. When is it enough? If the genocide in Gaza isn't enough, when would it be enough? Or is it never? You would always believe that we could answer the better angels of
it
our
would
nature.
It would be enough if we cease to be a democracy. Because that's a key part of the argument in the book, that the fact that we are a democracy makes us morally superior for a number of reasons. It's because we can self-correct. It's because we can change our foreign policy. We get the foreign policy we deserve. And I think one of the lessons of the Donald Trump era is that actually new leaders can actually radically change U.S. foreign policy. I mean, if you look at the latest national security strategy, it is a radical shift from what came before. So the pendulum can shift. We could theoretically have someone like Bernie Sanders being our president, and then we could actually meet our moral aspirations in a way that probably both you and I would be proud of. I think that's possible as long as we remain a democracy. That's the key issue here. And that's what makes us better than the alternatives, like China or Russia, for example.
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s. It works for members like...
I'm Haley, and I've lost 100 pounds. Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects. It's all in one place.
Weight Watchers handles the insurance for you and offers affordable cash pay options. With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
I'm Mike, and I've lost 135 pounds. Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
I'm Sharia, and I lost 80 pounds on Weight Watchers. I realized that it would take more than a prescription to lose weight and feel good on a GLP-1.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last.
I can't imagine doing a GLP-1 without Weight Watchers.
Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com/GLP-1. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now, it's your turn. Weight Watchers, watch it work.
I want to clarify this. So the reason that America is morally superior is because we're a democracy, which means that we could change. That is the logical.
That when we make
mistakes, other regimes could self-correct, though. That to me is a weak case. Other regimes obviously self-correct. Like this is, I mean, when you look at von Mises and Hayek, like the people who were extraordinarily anti-centralization of power, even they admitted that obviously these regimes aren't just static. Look at China. China's 5 million times more dynamic in the 21st century than the United States has been. But Derek is chomping at the bit. Derek, you go.
Well, I would go the other direction, Danny. I would say, look at what Xi Jinping has done to the Chinese system in terms of consolidating power. And like changing it from a party system, a cadre system to a system where most authority is invested in one man. That's a huge change. It's been a massive change in China, and it's been done by one guy in a non-democratic, you could say, system. That's still change. It's not positive change.
No, Derek, I agree with that. I'm agreeing with that, yeah.
But it's still change, and I think... Like, I mean, I want to talk about this in connection specifically with the Middle East, and we can come back to that. We don't have to do it right now. But I feel like there's a tension here in this book between the manifesto that you want to write about what the U.S. could do if it were a different country, basically, if it were a more moral actor on the world stage. And the argument that you're having with progressives that the U.S. is preferable to other countries as the global imperial power, it winds up being like the U.S. is preferable, or the U.S. would be preferable if it changed a lot of policies and did things in a positive way, in a way that we agree with as progressives. American power is good if it's used differently from how it's currently being used, which I think... You could write the same case for Russian power, Chinese power, any other power. If they do it differently, they use it differently than they're using it now, it would be good. It just doesn't stick, I think, to me. It's sort of, I don't know why the United States is uniquely the good actor here.
Well, the only reason to stick, Shoddy, is someone, you're critical of like woke and identity politics. The only reason it makes sense is because your own identity as basically an American who has a connection to Egypt, who wants Egypt to be more democratic. So it's ironic because I think this emerges from your identitarian position more than anything else.
Oh, interesting. Look, I don't know about that. Okay, there's a couple of things I want to raise here. The difference I was pointing to with, say, China, is that when the dear leader decides something, the citizens are not able to change that because they have no input or very little input into policy. So when Xi Jinping decides to have a zero COVID policy and is obsessed with that, it's very difficult to self-correct and undo that because the leader is so closely tied to that policy and he sees his own kind of legitimacy and legacy as tied to that. So these leaders can be very rigid. They don't have to contend with a fractious parliament or an opposition party or citizens who have a right to protest. So that makes it actually very difficult to see how Russian power can change or the Chinese approach vis-a-vis Taiwan is going to change. That is built in to the particular conception of the leader, and that leader is going to live probably for quite a bit longer. And that means that there's very little change that is possible, where the US has the potential to change every 4 or 8 years. So I think there is a fundamental difference there. I would also say that on balance, the US has been better than the available options as the hegemon. So this is not just theoretical. If only the US could be a lot better than it currently is, I think the US as it is still preferable to the other options. Now, I can't prove that 100% because we haven't lived under total Chinese hegemony. But I think it's one of those things that you have to kind of be careful what you wish for. And I'm positing that if we allowed that to happen, if we allowed for a Chinese-led hegemonic domination, that we would actually see, okay, the US was bad, but there was actually quite a bit good that was still going on.
Okay, let me jump in here because this is what I really wanted to see. This is like my biggest disagreement with you, I think, when you analyze international relations. Russia could barely conquer Ukraine. It can't conquer Ukraine. China, to me, has suggested it does not want a type of global hegemony akin to what the United States had from 1945 until roughly the 2010s. It certainly wants to dominate East Asia, for sure. Luckily for people who don't want domination, India, I think, is going to really prevent a lot of that from happening to a certain degree, maybe not a total degree. But like, I just don't see this sort of like Russian and Chinese plan for global domination. I think that like is a fantasy that emerges from actually what the United States tried to do. It's very akin to what George Kennan did, which is I think he read onto a relatively weak Soviet Union a project that the United States actually had, which is why by even the early 50s, Kennan turns against the United States and turns against containment and turns against the Cold War because he's actually like, oh, I was neurotically, he was a psychoanalysis guy. I was neurotically reading my own anxieties onto the Soviet Union, then what I had to fear was actually what the United States is doing, which is trying to construct a genuine global empire. So I think this is what American analysts have tended to do. They have tended to read America's own goals onto other nations that don't have the capabilities, Russia, or the desire or capabilities, frankly, China, to reimagine what the United States did after World War II in an extraordinarily unique situation where essentially the industrialized world had destroyed itself except for one country. So I really disagree with this fear-mongering about Russian
and
Chinese
hegemony.
But as you
know, Danny, there are conflicting accounts about Chinese ambitions. I mean, there are books like Rush Dashi's The Long Game that actually do seem to suggest that China does have long-term,
yeah, but they're wacky. They're
quite
wrong.
Expansive ambition. But you can't, right, you can just say that they're wrong, that's not really an argument. You have to be able to engage and say that maybe some other people who have studied this for a long time, who are actually China experts, might be onto something.
So what is the proof? Is it Belt and Road? That's the proof of that China wants to engage in resource extraction like every other great power throughout the entirety of history. There's no proof of it. It's just this sort of like anti-China fear-mongering. And really what I think it actually is anxiety about American decline. about the fact that the GDP of the United States, the GDP of the G7 has basically just been in decline for decades. Again, I think China wants to control all the island chains. I don't think China wants the United States in East Asia in any way, because why would any great power want that? Whether they're going to be able to affect that, I think is unlikely in the short term. In the medium and long term, they probably will be able to affect that, and we should be dealing with that reality. But what is the proof that China wants a presence in the Western Hemisphere, which is what global empire actually means? If it's making trade deals with Costa Rica, I just don't think that's akin to what the U.S. did with by occupying Japan and South Korea. It just is totally different categories.
We do see an expansionist approach in parts of Africa where China is really making inroads and trying to influence domestic policies in those countries. China does prefer authoritarian regimes over democratic ones, because if there are too many democratic governments in Africa and elsewhere, then it undermines the Chinese self-understanding that dictatorship and one leader rule is the best approach. So I think it is true, and I think it's hard to deny, that China wants to see more governments like it throughout the world. Maybe it doesn't pursue those ambitions in quite the same way that the US does. But to take it from another angle, because you said, I think correctly, that China, putting it's the question of whether it really wants to be a hegemon, a global hegemon, it doesn't have the capabilities. We overestimate China's power. And we've been obsessed with this idea of China's rise, but China actually has deep structural weaknesses on a lot of different metrics. So if you take that, what that means is that the case for American power is a descriptive case, that American power, American hegemony is going to be the way it is for the foreseeable future. China has no real chance to overtake the US in that regard. If that's the case, then we have to ask ourselves, if America is going to continue playing this outsized global role, then we have an option. We can try to restrain it and make it weaker and cut it down to size, which doesn't seem very plausible. Or we can accept US power and say, how do we improve it and make it better and more just? And I think the arguments that people make for restraint, for a new restrained neo-isolationist America, it's hard to imagine a president who's actually going to follow through on that and fundamentally change America's international character. So at some level, we have to deal with the world as it is and as it's going to be, and work with what we have. And that's really a key message of my book and so much of my writing, is that even if you don't like America, it is going to be dominant. So you have no choice but to try to make its dominance more moral and more positive in the rest of the world. There is no alternative. And I'm still, and we've had this conversation before, I hear a very strong diagnosis of the problem. And, you know, Chomsky was very good at this, of pointing out all of America's sins. And I'm sympathetic to that. We have a terrible record in a lot of different, in specific parts of the world. But then what do we do about that? And my argument has always been, just because we've done bad things in the past doesn't mean we're doomed to repeat them in the future. There's something very deterministic about this idea that America is incapable of change.
Just very, very quickly, I think you are basically a turn of the 20th century progressive, in that you think that human beings have the capacity to manage international affairs in a way that I think the 20th century disproved. I think it's too complex a thing to manage, essentially, that human agents can actually direct capital H history in that way. So I think this is probably our fundamental disagreement. I think the small c conservative criticism of that from the mid 20th century is not wrong, that you actually, like, you can't have the faith in social science that people did, the scientistic faith in global management that people have had. And so, I think that might just be the fundamental disagreement. I think it's a doomed project, like, from the inception, because just life doesn't work that way.
So what's your alternative? If it's doomed, then what do we do?
I think that the United States obviously should restrain its power. And I think that it should be left up to the regions of the world to determine what their own histories will be, because an external force is not able to meaningfully direct that absent basically world-ending war as happened in Germany and Japan. And I don't think that's going to happen, and I don't think that should happen. And so I think the United States needs to let other other regions of the world organically develop and democratically, in a small D sense, determine what their future should be. And that you can't actually impose structures outside from outside, because it doesn't work. It just doesn't work in the medium term. Do you think that's what I think should be?
Do you think it's plausible or realistic that the U.S. is going to restrain itself to such a degree that it no longer plays much of a role in all of these regions? Because we're so intertwined in the world and we're so globally connected in terms of economic trade and cooperation.
I think over time, the material realities. Yeah, the material, they're already happening in East Asia. And I think this is the big piece I run on Harper's for it. Like the trend lines are just down. Like from, if you take 1945 as the high point, and you should, where the US controlled like 50% of world exports, it's just been down. So think, where is it going to be in 100 years? It's going to be a lot less than it is now. So yes, I do think it happens. And the question to me is not if, but when and how we deal with that decline. And so pretending that the United States is not going to decline in terms of its ability to dominate world regions, I wouldn't say manage, because it never effectively managed. Look, at the United States hasn't really won a war since 1945, except the Gulf War. To dominate world affairs is going to decrease over time. And the question is, how do we deal with that? And if we could deal with it more wisely, which would lead to less death and destruction, or we could deal with it by saying things will never change, which will lead to more death and destruction. That's my ultimate take on that. But I know Derek has a question, but Shadi, feel free to respond if you'd like.
I'll just respond very quickly on that. The story of American decline is a long one. We've always had this thought that we're on the verge of declining. There's all these books that were written in the 60s, 70s, 80s. The crisis of democracy has always been a theme. We have this kind of sense of we're always in a state of malaise. That was what Jimmy Carter was talking about in the late 70s, the crisis of confidence. When people wrote books like The Suicide of the West, this is a long theme. That decline didn't actually happen. So we have to be very careful about assuming that this time it's going to be real, when in previous instances it wasn't. I'll also just note that the American economy is very strong and vibrant. If I recall, our GDP was something like 17 or 18 trillion in 2008. It's almost doubled since then, unlike Europe. So there is a real story here of a resilient American economy.
No, it's
economy.
Fucking fake GDP, Shadi. It's fucking financialized assets that are bullshit. We can't even build electric cars. Come on. This is the problem with macroeconomic statistics.
You can't just dismiss metrics.
Yes, you
that
can.
Don't
it's a
accord.
Fucking fake project, dude. Like, macroeconomics is ridiculous. It's ridiculous. This is why the Democrats keep on losing.
You're not an economist. To all due respect, you're not an economist, Danny. I'm not an economist.
They're not historians.
Yeah, and historians aren't always right.
No, just usually. No, that's not true. All the resistance historians are wrong. No, but I do think macroeconomic. There's a leap of faith. This is what I wrote my first book about. If you look to the foundational moments of these social sciences, there are so many ontological leaps about what you're able to actually accurately measure that I think it makes a lot of the project problematic, which is why a lot of social science is replication crisis, right? It's not for nothing that you basically can't replicate findings in social science because they're not genuine sciences, which is why philosophers of science like Karl Popper, who actually tried to develop a philosophy of social science, gave up because they're not real sciences. So there's this scientific faith in rational analysis, which is connected to your faith in the ability to manage international affairs that, again, I just think the 20th century has proven wrong. Basically, the history of psychology is just every single one of its foundational studies being proven incorrect, because things like mind, things like international affairs are not actually able to be subject to the type of rigorous scientific analysis that physics, or to some a lesser degree, but still real degree, biology is able to be subject to. It's just incorrect. It's a false premise. And anyone who wants to listen to this, I think I did like an hour debate with Glenn Lowry, who is an economist, about this.
That's a whole conversation on its own. Obviously, I disagree that we just dismiss all the social scientists and say
no. They're tools. They're tools. They're tools that are not basically more true than more qualitative analyses. There are tools in the toolbox that can be useful.
But the
I use GDP measurement. It is a tool, but the way that people use it as like the be-all and end-all, which is very paradigmatic of the United States after World War II, is to me problematic.
On another point, the 21st century does show that great men and women actually can change the course of their countries. As I alluded to earlier, George W. Bush had a radically different foreign policy. The neocons captured the levers of state power, and they went ahead with a destructive war in Iraq that probably wouldn't have happened otherwise. Barack Obama had a very different foreign policy than George W. Bush, and actually tried to restrain and limit American power in certain ways in response to the overreach of George W. Then we had Donald Trump, who also had a radically different foreign policy than Barack Obama. And so we can see how leaders actually do matter. It's not as if the U.S. is some...
It's only radical from Washington, D.C. It was all within the frame of primacy, dude. Yeah.
But you have to acknowledge that there are changes that leaders can actually
bring
about. There
are changes, yes. Not that radical, though.
I think they're changes on the margins. Like, I don't see these radical shifts. The goals, the main focus, the areas, even in the new national security strategy, which has some shocking comments that are, you know, overtly white nationalist, overtly imperialist. I don't think it's that big a meaningful material change. Like, it's in some cases, what Trump does is he says things out loud that have been practiced as policy without people talking about it openly for decades. Like, I don't see this radical shift. And I think to talk about it in those terms, to say that America is different and better from Russia and China because every 4 years or every 8 years, there's the opportunity to completely remake U.S. foreign policy and the way that it acts in the world, it elides the fact that there are established interests that dominate the politics of this country, especially in foreign policy, just as much as there are in China and Russia, and maintain status quo because that what they want is to sell weapons, to protect the oil, to, you know, whatever it is in any given part of the world, they're getting what they want out of the way that foreign policy in this country operates. And that's where there's, I think, more continuity between these administrations than change.
So a prediction here, and we won't know for a long time, but I'm willing to wager that in 10 or 15 years, at least one of the major parties is going to have quite a different policy on Israel-Palestine because the base of the Democratic Party has become significantly more pro-Palestine. That is where the party is. Its center of gravity has shifted.
Just for and Palestine to be destroyed. I mean, like, this
what?
Is like when
no,
all
no,
the...
No, no, just no. in time.
Yeah. Sorry, yeah, no, just, I think you're misunderstanding. I think, no, I'm saying that we're going to have a more balanced policy that is more pro-Palestinian, that is willing to put more pressure on Israel and use our leverage through our military aid to actually get Israel to behave better or at least not as bad.
Dude, Palestine won't exist. This is like when all the reform... It's like I did that Harper's piece on Hollywood and one of the people that I interviewed said that there are going to be all these ways to make writers' rooms great just in time for writers' rooms not to exist anymore. And I think we can't ignore the fact that Palestine as a sovereign political unit is not going to be, unless things radically change really soon, in a very good position by the time that happens. And I think that's the story more than anything else.
But Israel will still exist. It will still have a large military aid package that we give to them. There is a possibility that some Democratic leaders we might see in 2028, that could be a litmus test, that if you're not actually more balanced on this question, you might not actually win because Democratic voters want to see someone who understands the horrors of Gaza. That's what they're looking for in a president, I hope. Let's say I'm right on that. Then we could actually have a situation in, say, 10 years where we suspend military aid to Israel if it annexes entirely the West Bank. I don't think Palestine
sure, but
will...
That's extraordinarily hypothetical. I mean, really, like that's... Let's say in 10 years that you're right. Okay, what if in 10 years you're wrong? Like it's as easily... You could as easily imagine no change happening because, again, the entrenched interests as opposed to the base of the party are in favor of continuing to supply Israel with not just... status quo military aid, but greater and greater amounts of military aid.
But then it sounds to me like you guys are conceding a lot. You're saying that it's hopeless and we just have to accept that China and Russia are going to carve up their own spheres of influence. China will dominate East Asia. Russia will dominate parts of Eastern Europe and its near surroundings. And we just have to...
I mean, I'm not saying you don't fight for it politically. I'm questioning using that as an assumption to then make the case that America is good or better than the alternative, because maybe theoretically in 10 years we will have made this major change in U.S. foreign policy. I don't think that's a strong argument.
But it's an argument that I think is important if you want to actually change people and how they engage with the system. And that's part of what I hope I can do in my writing, that I give people hope so they don't resign themselves to their fate. Because if progressives like you guys exit the system and you give up hope and you say that things are going to be the way they are and we have no control over them because of structural realities, that's a very hopeless place to be. And it's a scary place to be as well, to have a growing number of Americans completely losing faith in the American project and saying that we can't be better because there is something entrenched about who we are that makes us bad. That's what I want to fight against, because why else do we write? Why else do we advocate? Why else do we try to persuade? Because we want more Americans to have more hope in a more moral country. And if we could use our power for good, wouldn't that be a better outcome than just managing our decline with a happy face?
So, I mean, I think, again, this is where, to go back to something we talked about a little earlier, there's a discordance here, I think, in the book between making the case for a better American foreign policy and describing current U.S. foreign policy as preferable. I mean, not good necessarily, but preferable. And I think that's what people will take issue with. I want to stick with the Middle East, because I think this is where the divergence between the imagined foreign policy that you're advocating and the reality of U.S. foreign policy is at its most stark. And some of the things that you talk about in the book, I think elides to some degree the way the U.S. acts in the region. There's a sense of, like, you talk about the U.S. propping up authoritarian Arab states, the monarchies in the Persian Gulf, Egypt, as though it's an exception to American power and not the product of American power or American power acting in the world. Or you say, you know, the U.S. isn't using its power in a moral way in this place, as though it's like, this is some unique failing and not the way it works, like the way it functions, because again, there are entrenched interests that want the U.S. to be in this part of the world dealing with these countries in this particular way. When you talk about the war in Yemen, you talk about it as the Saudi and UAE's military intervention as a criticism of those countries, without noting that two U.S. administrations backstopped that intervention completely and were instrumental in creating the humanitarian crisis there. You talk about Sisi in Egypt as a malign actor, which I agree he is. It's an authoritarian state. He's a malign actor in Libya and Sudan are two places you talk about. But the U.S. pays for Sisi's, I mean, the U.S. pays for Sisi to remain in power. It pays for the Egyptian military. Like that's, again, backstopped by the United States. So I think it's a real challenge to try and make both of these cases at the same time, because the divergence between what the U.S., I guess, could be in theory and what the U.S. is can be so stark, especially in regions like this.
Yes, and I do talk about a Middle East exception, and I think you guys would disagree with that. It sounds like you are disagreeing with that. Not to kind of rehash this, but the U.S. did get more serious about democracy promotion in other regions of the world in the 1990s. The exception was the Middle East. We weren't perfect in those other regions, but there was some progress and there was some spread of democratic regimes outside of the Middle East. there was something about the Middle East in particular for complex reasons. One of them is our obsession with elevating Israel's interests above all else. But I don't think that's a foregone conclusion. I don't think we had to support the war in Yemen. I don't think we had to back away from the Arab Spring and support Sisi. And those were major internal debates in the Obama administration and in the Bush administration during the Freedom Agenda in 2004, 2005, about whether we should do more to support democracy in the Middle East. The pro-democracy folks lost those debates internally, but that's again where personnel and individuals matter. It didn't have to be that way. The Arab Spring did not have to end in the destructive way that it ended. Individuals, including Barack Obama, made key choices at key times. I think that the coup in Egypt could have been prevented if Obama and his top aides had made different decisions in a very short period of time in June and July 2013. I don't like to think, maybe in hindsight, everything seems inevitable after the fact. But that's not the way it was at the time. It was in flux. And again, I think it's a weird way of looking at history to say that just because something happened, it means that it had to have happened that way. There's no room for agency. There's no room for individuals. There's no room for the choices that people make at certain moments of time. And maybe that's just a fundamental disagreement about how we understand history. I do think there's a kind of hindsight bias there.
I think when the decisions that get made are in keeping with decades of U.S. policy in the region, you have to talk about why that continuity exists and what are the interests and institutions that maintain it despite the change in individuals and despite the fact that, yes, individuals have agency and can change policy, but they don't. Even in cases where, as I think I would argue for Barack Obama, they know better. And there are many things that I would say that about with Obama, including bailing out the banks and the housing crisis and leaving the homeowners to flounder. But he made the choices that he made. And I think it's important to also look at the reasons why that happens, the reasons why the continuity exists.
It's a fair point. I'll give you one example that I think shows pretty clearly how individuals mattered at a key moment. Obama didn't want to go ahead with the NATO intervention in Libya in 2011, but it was top aides like Ben Rhodes and Samantha Power who persuaded him, even though he was reluctant, to actually, you know, lead the NATO intervention or lead from behind, as the phrase went at the time. And you might say that Libya was another example of a disastrous U.S. intervention. I'm actually one of the last people on the planet who thinks that it was a right and justified intervention because there was a mass slaughter underway, and we actually stopped that mass slaughter. Now, Libya didn't turn out great, but I do think that when either a mass slaughter or a genocide is happening and we have the power to stop it or to reduce the killing.
Do you not see a connection between that and Gaza, though? This is what blows my... Shadi, that is directly linked to Gaza.
How is Libya connected to Gaza?
Because the U.S. has the power to do both. This is what I don't get. So, like, why would you think it would do the good one and not the bad one? It has never done that. It is so... It is just, I just don't understand.
There are other, and I'll just say that there are other good interventions. I mean, we were late in the game and people can have issues with the final outcome with the Dayton Accords, but we did help stop the Bosnian genocide in the early 1990s. We did intervene in Kosovo in 1999 to stop the ethnic cleansing there. When Iraq invaded Kuwait and occupied it, we were the only power that could stop that. There are examples where the U.S. uses its power for good, and we can't just memory hole them. So yes, there are bad interventions, but there are also good interventions. What that tells me is that there's nothing intrinsically bad about U.S. intervention. Does that make sense? It can be one or the other.
Yeah,
and we should be against bad interventions, but we should be supportive of good interventions.
Yeah, but you didn't answer my question, which is that they go together. That's the whole point.
I'm still not 100% following if you're because saying that
if a malign actor, let's just admit that Obama was heaven sent and Donald Trump is Satan himself. They're both leaders of the United States within a year of each other. So having the power is going to lead to good and bad because that is the nature of politics. It just doesn't make sense to me that there's just nothing, literally nothing, that would suggest you could have the good without the bad. And the bad has been horrible, as you know, on Gaza and many other instances, Vietnam, Korea, et cetera, all the interventions. It just, there's just no reason to believe that we would ever be able to get the good without the horrible and brutal. No reason.
If that's what you think, then maybe it points to a deeper reality that any country or any empire, if we want to use that word, or hegemon, has a lot of power, that there is going to be good with bad. But I don't think that wouldn't necessarily change if there was another empire then. There's nothing specific to the U.S., according to your own argument. You're just saying that this is the reality of life, that we have to accept the good with the bad.
That's why empires are bad. Exactly. I'm an anti-imperialist. I in an ideal world, no one would be able to dominate
other. But there are hegemons and there are regional hegemons. And that's inescapable in the real world.
Yeah. So then what you would want to do is you'd want to build democratic connect. What I think would actually happen is you'd want to build more democratic equal connections between, for example, the countries of North America. Canada and Mexico are already the number one and two trading partners. So that is a material basis through which to build a more theoretically, at least over time, regional bloc that would be democratic. And eventually you get one world government and we all live in humanistic peace together. And that's certainly not going to happen with the United States trying to dominate East Asia. I promise you that.
Well, what is your view on so another thing we haven't really talked about, I mean, the U.S. is different than other nations in the sense that it was founded on a distinct moral purpose and that every president up until
Donald Trump... Yeah, like the Three-Fifths Compromise. I mean, it's just like...
Oh, no, come on. Okay, but now you're just cherry-picking the worst. I'm not denying that
there's... I'm not cherry-picking. They had slavery until 1863.
I know, but you're... Of course, but no one denies that there were horrific aspects...
It's ridiculous. My point is, it's ridiculous to go back to the founding. Who gives a shit?
But there was always a moral...
The U.S. was founded on. Who cares?
Okay, but that's different than other countries. Most countries,
the Chinese Communist Party is founded on the beautiful humanistic beliefs of everyone is equal. Juche communism is founded on these wonderful beliefs of democratic participation. It's just an absurd argument that only has valence in this country because we are fetishists for the founding fathers. You could say that about any movement. They're all founded with good faith, regardless of what happens.
What I'm saying was that there was a built-in moral aspiration.
Same with Leninist cadre, Soviet Union. Say about anything.
But those were really bad moral aspirations. This is where
just because you're an American.
No, it's because I'm not a communist who thinks that Stalin was good or Lenin was good. So of course.
So do you think Thomas Jefferson was good? Do you think that he basically raped enslaved people and didn't free his children? Was that good? I mean, you can make this about anything. My point is, it's a silly argument because we could go back and forth with every single leader in this country forever. There's no point of it. Who cares what the United States was supposedly founded on? You could find the good, you could find the bad, just like you could do with any basic political party or nation state throughout modern history. Because a lot of those states were using the language of the Declaration of Independence when they were making their own non-democratic capitalist constitutions.
But as you know, Danny, those documents pointed the way forward and it allowed us to actually move in a progressive direction when it came to race and these other things that haunted our founding, because they were built into our documents, this idea that all human beings have inherent worth and dignity, and that there was a premise of equality that was baked in. And we can then resort back to our founding documents as the civil rights leaders did when they wanted to make their case in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. So the fact that we have something to turn back to that actually has a strong moral content does give us the possibility for becoming better. I just don't think there's a real argument to make that our founding was intrinsically evil and we just discarded. It still unites us. The fact that we have a shared constitution.
It's not intrinsically anything. That's the point. It's just something that happened in history that you could take the good and the bad. It doesn't provide like a source of moral authority that trickles down through the centuries. I imagine if we looked at what Mao said with the founding of the People's Republic, you would find very similar language. Maybe even language taken from the American founding. It just doesn't matter. To me, it's a non-issue. it's not like a real claim. That's like saying, oh, it's like the Bible. The Bible has good stuff, but we also don't stone our children when they eat fish on Friday night or whatever it was. I forget what it says in Leviticus. It's just like purposeless and certainly not a guide for politics or international relations or the United States is in history. That's for sure.
But even if the Bible and the Quran aren't followed in the way they should be, they provide a North Star. They provide guidance. They give us a sense of what we should aspire to. And countries need that. And most countries don't have that. We're an ideological nation. We were founded on a particular mission. Individual policy.
I don't think you know enough to say that. I think you don't know enough to say that countries don't have that. That whatever Russian no. Federation was founded, the founding documents of the Russian Federation or the People's Republic or the Democratic People's Republic of North Korea. I'm sure their founding documents say very, very. I'm sure they all say relatively similar things.
But they don't have.
Except
there'll
be some more Communist Party stuff probably in the.
But most countries are, as you know, are traditional nation states that are defined pretty narrowly. Like Sweden doesn't have a kind of like a moral vision of what the rest of the world should be. It's mostly concerned about what happens in its own borders.
Yeah, because we're settler colonial. That's a bad thing. That we felt that we could impose our ideals on the indigenous peoples of this country who we genocided. I don't know. I think you see where this is going. But Shadi, I want to give you the final word, but we do have to let you go. Why should people buy your book? Tell them why they should buy the book.
Thank you. Okay, thanks. Yeah, I think there are good reasons to buy the book. One is, they're going to be challenged and hopefully they'll wrestle with me. I wrestled with this book. As I said earlier, I have doubts about American power and it was difficult to write this book, but I think it's a good thing to have a book that is nuanced and where people can challenge their own starting assumptions about America. And I hope they can see a roadmap for an America that actually lives up to their own ideals. And in that sense, it's a hopeful book. And I think that it's better to err on the side of hope and ambition, even if we disagree about the history. So I hope people can see that. And if that inspires them to stay in the system, to engage in politics, to vote for different leaders who represent their ideals in a way that they're proud of, and to be proud of at least some of the things our country stands for, despite all of our faults, I think that's something we need, especially now, at a time when everyone's depressed about the American project.
Well, let's end on that note of depression. Shadi, I genuinely love when you come on the show because I know we can yell at each other and no one will get offended. Everyone, check out The Case for American Power. And Shadi writes regularly for The Washington Post. Also, Wisdom of Crowds, I forgot to mention at the beginning. Check out that Substack. And Shadi, I'm sure we will yell at each other again in the future. Thank you so much for joining us.
I would love to. Always enjoy Danny and Derek. Thanks so much for having me.
The new Wegovy pill is now available through Weight Watchers. Powerful GLP-1 results in a simple pill at the lowest price available. And with Weight Watchers, you can get doctor support and personalized nutrition programs. See if you qualify at weightwatchers.com. Ad not reviewed or approved by Novo Nordisk.